Today's show is sponsored by Audible, and today's novel, The High King by Lloyd Alexander, is available on audible.com, along with over 180,000 other titles to choose from. A novel podcast listeners can get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. Due to the wealth of topics that the novels in today's episode present, this episode has been split into two parts. You are now listening to part two. Part 1 was released on the 1st of February, 2017.
And so when he sees through the guise, I love the description of him turning into a shadow and trailing around the corner. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, the companions meet back up, and that's when Akron's gone missing. She runs out into the Hall of Warriors to try and find him.
Oh, there's Mag. They have the confrontation.
Oh, with yes.
Yeah, before he gets to... Yeah. This is a complicated.
Meg met a really painful death.
Yes.
Similar to Perdiri's death as well, but.
Mag finally gets his just rewards, and then Akron is able to flesh out where Aron was hiding, but she's not able to destroy him. What does it take to destroy Aron?
Darnwin.
That's to be Darnwin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. It takes a strike from Taran, who's carrying Durnwin, and he cleaves the serpent in two. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the serpent returns to the form of a man. But I guess I wanted to mention that, yes, Lloyd Alexander never describes what Aron looks like in his true form. You don't even see his face, even when he's dead. And then he turns, I think, to ashes or crumbles to dust.
Yeah.
And the ground where he crumbles is it looks charred, like it's permanently ruined.
Yeah.
And he never describes what the symbol on Aron's flag is either.
Yep.
He doesn't. Yeah. He mentions it as a black flag, and I always imagined that on it was either a white dragon or a white serpent.
Huh. When someone asked him about it, he responded, he said, you know, I could imagine something extremely scary and I could describe it into words, but the act of putting it into words automatically makes it less scary than what you picture in your head.
Yeah.
Like Aron's face.
Or even Taran's appearance, which we're never told of for purposes of effect, I suppose.
I always think of the Lord of the Rings film. And the scene, you know, in the book, we're never told what Sauron looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then in the film, you know, I think it may be only in the director's cut, or I can't remember. But there's the scene of the battle where, you know, he's this giant thing with a mace and he's, you know.
That's in the prelude to the first movie.
Yeah, it's in the prelude. And it just looks so ridiculous. And you know, they take this very mysterious, shadowy figure, and suddenly he just looks like a comic book character.
Yeah.
And I was so glad that, you know, that we don't have that in this book, because it ruins some of it. You want it to be the scariest thing you can think of, and that's going to be different for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And in parallel, how fascinating is it that in this series, the two characters for whom we're not given any sort of physical description are the main protagonist and the main antagonist.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, as you guys mentioned earlier, Mag, and I've mentioned this before because it always strikes me, I am a fan of the Harry Potter series, but the parallels here are whacking you on the head again. At the end of, and if you haven't read Harry Potter and you want to, spoiler alert, but at the end of that series, you have a character who is a henchman of evil who's promised great things, but then when he tries to seize those great things for himself, it's a trap, and he is destroyed by a gift that he was given. And then here you have that exact same thing happening with Mag. And then at the end of Harry Potter, you have the serpent being cleaved in twain by a magical sword, and that being the destruction of the Dark Lord.
I wonder if J.K. Rowling read the Prydain Chronicles.
I thought she's mentioned it. But go ahead.
And then again, with Harry Potter, you have, and this is classic Bulldungsren run, I'm sure, but you have a character where it is in the beginning of the book, you know, he's growing up, and you're seeing everything through the Harry filter. But then as you get towards the end of the book, you see more and more scenes written from outside of his perspective.
That's mm-hmm. true. I've seen other characters like Meg in many other stories as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the TV show Arrow, there's a Meg type character
mm-hmm.
who is promised lots of things, promised power.
Mm-hmm.
And then close to the end of the second season, he's like, wait a second, the city's being destroyed. I won't have a city to rule.
Mm-hmm.
And the main villain's like, well, yeah, well, too bad.
Yeah.
I think Wormtongue comes to mind as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as I'm coming across these parallels, I'm realizing that it's not something that started with Alexander and then just was picked up by Rowling or whoever else. It's a line that goes back to antiquity, which we saw with Koschei the Deathless into Morda into Voldemort.
Yeah. These are just things that resonate across history.
Mm-hmm.
And culture, really.
So I'm realizing now there was one incredibly poignant thing that we missed, and that is in the battle that took place in King Smoit's castle. We lost a character there.
Oh my gosh, how could we skip over that?
Last rune, we also lost Call.
Yes.
And Call's
death.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did not see Call's death coming.
Hmm.
When I went through it the first time, I was really taken by surprise, and I thought, oh my gosh, just like Adain,
mm-hmm.
Lloyd Alexander is not afraid to kill characters in front of you. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, who's going to make it out of this now? It's like watching Titanic for the first time.
Well, that's certainly one of the themes of the whole book, and you see that very poignantly at the very end, is the theme of loss.
Yeah.
And how Taran, even earlier in the book, when he meets Taliesin, he says, you know, some don't gain their wisdom without first experiencing loss and all of these challenges. And are you one that has to experience that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, throughout his story, but specifically in this book, that theme of loss is just so heavy.
Yeah.
And there's also in this book in particular, there's just a sense of now there's so many things left undone. These losses that are crucial in some way. You know, you have Rune has now left behind a kingdom without a ruler. Mm-hmm. And Call leaving behind a farm with no farmer, which is perhaps not as significant in the grand scheme, yet very significant to Taran.
Mm-hmm.
You see him making all these kind of silent promises to the people he loves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, come back and do something about all this.
And so
with
Aron finally defeated.
Well, let's see, Aron's fortress crumbles.
Yes.
And either right before or right after that, they get to view the actual, Taliesin's able to read it as the actual original inscription on Durnwin comes to light and then fades just as quickly.
Explaining why it says,
draw Durnwin, only thou of noble worth, to rule with justice, to strike down evil. Who wields it in good cause shall slay even the Lord of Death.
So it was always right there in front of them.
And of course, now you realize what the book, but it was said in the beginning of the book that if he's out, Aron is abroad, hiding in the guise of other people, he must be desperate. There's a reason that he wants this sword. And it's upon the destruction of the Cauldron Boy that you realize that significance. And it goes even further when you read that inscription. But eventually, once the battle was done and the dust settles, they do make it back to Cair Dalbyn, and they're having a discussion. Dalbyn's brought everybody together, and he's saying that now that the Lord of Death has been defeated, the Sons of Dawn have to leave for the Summer Country, and we're going to be taking everything and anything magical with us, and the fair folk are going to go underground and abandon the wayposts, and pretty much you guys are all welcome to come with us if you would like. What did you guys think of this?
Including Glue, by the way, and Gurgi.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was quite a gracious extension. Dalbyn said even Glue has served in his own way. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, even just the slightest bit makes him worthy of a gracious gift in the eyes of the giver of that gift.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, there was a mention in a previous episode about is there a Christian theme anywhere? And I don't think Lloyd ever said that there explicitly is, but if there is anything that I can point out, I think it's here. Mm. Is that they're given the chance, that they're given the opportunity essentially to get to heaven without dying.
And Dalbin says to Taran, and this is significant here, he says, Taran says something like, are you serious? This is all I ever wanted, was just to be able to live a peaceful life with Ilanwe. And he says, Taran says, is this really true? And Dalbin says, I have no better gift in my power to bestow upon you. So then night falls, and Taran's got a visitor.
Three visitors.
Three visitors.
And this one I think I saw coming. Yeah.
We've gone over twice already the theme of weaving and what Taran sees in, and of course it's the three witches from the Marshes of Morva in the guise of the Fair Maidens.
So it's hinted that that's actually their true appearance.
Yes, I agree. Although Orgok is still carnivorous, yes, which still disturbs me.
But we saw in their cottage, we saw the tapestry that was apparently being woven. You never saw it being worked on, but you saw it get bigger, more complete between the second and the fourth book. And now they're giving it to Taran as a gift. But he makes note, but it's not complete. And they say, well, of course, that is your job. It is your job to complete it.
They also make note that they're not actually giving it to him. It's his to begin with.
Right.
This is the tapestry of his life. And he says it's incomplete. Well, of course it's incomplete. You must still choose the pattern. And until Taran's last day, he must still choose the pattern. So it is for all of us.
And so between that and various other thoughts that he's having, when they get up the next day, he goes to see Dalbin, and he has to tell them, I can't travel with you to the summer country.
Ugh.
And of course they ask,
yeah,
why? And Ilanwe's entirely distraught. And how did this resonate with you guys?
Well, that's
this way
that makes this so difficult is throughout the whole book. I mean, when he got separated with Ilanwe earlier, I mean, he was devastated, and he kept thinking of Ilanwe. And yet here he's faced with this choice that he could go and spend forever in a peaceful life with her, or to stay knowing that she would have to go and he would be separated from her, and yet he still decides to stay.
Because, and one of you mentioned earlier, because of the unfinished work and the incomplete promises that had been made.
Yeah.
It's like the book, we all, up to this point, we thought the book was about the final battle with Anuvin, but really it's all about what all that led him to this choice.
This is, I remember this scene really well, you know, listening to it in the audiobook, and I was, you know, I was absolutely crushed. I'm thinking there's got to be some way, and I can't figure out any way, you know, out of this situation where he's actually not going to get her.
I was always kind of frustrated. I mean, I was devastated, obviously, by the scene. And then for a long time, I was kind of frustrated by her reaction. It just didn't seem extreme enough. She's always so, you know, forceful in stating her opinion, and so very, I don't know, just passionate in her emotions, that to, you know, she has this kind of outburst, and then he starts explaining why he's made this choice, and then she just immediately kind of accepts it. And I always thought, gosh,
oh, no, she
I just
want
to see her fight it more, you know. I actually, thinking about this, and this is just me, you know, making up the stuff in my head, but there's a part of me that thinks that she probably she sympathizes with his point of view, because if you think about what they've done, they've spent all this time and blood, sweat, and tears saving this country, and now they get to leave it. And there's kind of an injustice there. There's a surprising kind of unfairness, and I know life's not fair, and Lloyd certainly makes that clear to us in the book. But I have a moment in a story that I wrote about them where they're just kind of looking out over the fields, and where the people from the Comets are camping out in Caer Dalbyn. And she's looking out saying, look at them all. What are they going to do now? And what have we fought for? Have we only fought for just the right to leave and then just leave them all leaderless and, you know, with the country torn apart? And it came to me with at that point that I really think that if she'd have known she'd had the choice, she would have chosen the same. Anyway, she would have done the same thing he had done. And of course, eventually she does make that choice. But it comforted me a little bit. And because we also have people, you know, feminists getting up in arms about the whole idea that she gives up her agency to be with him. And oh, she gives up her power and she could have done this. But no, she stays to be, you know, the romantic partner, and feeling like that's somehow a disservice to her. And I don't feel that way at all. I think that, yes, OK, she stays because she loves him, but she also stays from the same sense of duty that he does.
Yes,
I believe.
And they've proved time and time again throughout the books that they do make a really good team. She tempers him in a really good way, and he pushes her forward in an excellent way as well. She would be a great leader with him at her side.
I've got the actual paragraph here, and this is where, when I was listening to the audiobook, I started crying too. Ailanui was about to turn away, but suddenly, from Taran, that is, but suddenly her blue eyes flashed furiously and she stamped her foot. "It's not fair," she cried. "It's not my fault I was born into a family of enchantresses. I didn't ask for magical powers." "That's worse than being made to wear a pair of shoes that doesn't fit. I don't see why I have to keep them." Now, except for the last two sentences there, "It's not my fault I was born into a family of enchantresses." You know, this is the, you know, she's, you know, both she and I, were I Taran, would be bawling out loud at that point, because there's nothing you can do. He's mm-hmm. got to stay mm-hmm. for duty, and she has to go by mm-hmm. her magical nature.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. I see, again, when I see people criticizing this point, the critics seem to equate her magical powers with her agency. And I think that misses the point, because yeah.
could,
in all these
could
books,
you define her agency?
Well, when, you know, what's when feminists speak
what's
of
the
agency,
distinction?
When I would
her
say
ability to do stuff on her own.
Yeah, her ability to do stuff on her own, her ability to make her own decision. And like somehow a woman has to have magic in order to be powerful. And that misses the point, because it's her agency to want to get rid of them. Her magic has defined her life to a certain extent, in a way that would be very restrictive to her. You know, like she says, she never asked to be born into this family. We don't know what her life would have been had her family survived and she'd actually been raised, you know, in the proper place, but possibly even more restrictive, because then she would never have even had a chance to escape, had she wanted to, from, you know, her heritage as an enchantress. And well, this is who you are. This is who you have to be. So really, this scene where she's, you know, actually given the choice to wish the powers away, which have never done her any good, you know, in a practical sense. They've nearly gotten her killed multiple times, but they've never been truly useful to her. That she is given the choice to be able to relinquish that in order to stay behind and again, make the same sacrifice as Taran. She gives up immortality and peace and safety in order to stay behind in this place that's become, you know, chaos and hardship. And that's a huge, it blows my mind that anybody could see that as anything but an incredibly powerful moment for her. I mean, that she marries him is sort of even beside the point. That's like a nice bonus.
I agree with you that she stayed out of a sense of duty like Taran did.
Yeah. Well, you didn't actually say what Taran becomes. Are we going to leave that?
Well, that's a good point, because what, you know, that comes back to what I said earlier was Dalban saying, "I have no better gift in my power to bestow upon you." Without saying it, however, what he means in the back of his head is, but you have the power to choose to be the High King of Prydain, because that is the prophecy that was written in the Book of Three. But he had to choose it on his own. And it was, I felt, a really well-written prophecy that kind of explains everything that Dalban's been doing up to this point. And it wasn't some kind of like really intricate plot that he was trying to weave. It's more a, this is what the book says could happen. let me see if that's the way it plays out.
It also explains the secret one-on-one meetings he had with Gwydion throughout the books.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I want to know what went
and it helps, you know, you talked about the theme of the bookends and everything coming full circle.
Mm-hmm.
The Book of Three itself comes full circle
mm-hmm.
in that ending and describing Terran's story arc.
Mm-hmm. It really just is this perfect little circle.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Every little thread in the tapestry is tied up nice and neat and nothing mm-hmm. is left unfinished or loose.
But it's really amazing. It's done in writing. Such a way that it does not at all feel contrived. And I've never been able to put my finger on what it is that is so fresh about it. Because normally when I find books are tied up in a neat little bow like that, I kind of go, well, that was convenient.
Yeah.
But yeah. I did not feel that way at the end of this book. I felt overjoyed.
I think it's done because Terran goes through that hard decision-making process. Because if he would have chosen to go to the Summer Country, everything wouldn't have been wrapped up so neatly.
Yeah.
But because Lloyd takes you with Terran through that decision-making process and you really struggle with him and you feel those fears and those anxieties and the sorrow, then when he does make that decision and everything comes together, it feels more of a reward mm-hmm. than, wait, that just felt forced.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you also have the element of losing, you know, most of the other characters that we've grown to love to the Summer Country, which, though it's very happy for them, is heartbreaking.
Bittersweet.
Yeah, very bittersweet for the story itself. So that
Taran
kind of helps balance it, I think.
Taran and Ailanwy are actually, you know, when you count to, I think I'm right on this, is like they have nobody left out of the companions. Mm-hmm. Everybody went to the Summer Country, and it's just the two of them mm-hmm. now who have to lead the entire land.
And Henwen.
Right. And Hanwha. But she doesn't really count if there's no oracularness right. about her.
Yeah.
Poinch. I also like it that in the very last paragraph of the novel, Lloyd does once and only once call them King Taran and Queen Ailanwy.
Mm-hmm.
I like that too. I think there's a symbolism, the fact that they come back and Henwen has had piglets. And this is something that we've discussed a little bit over at our author forum. The land of Prydain seems a little barren. You have the Red Fallows as the most literal example of that. But then there's very few children that you see in this series. You have all these kings who don't seem to have any queens and don't seem to have a lot of heirs. You know, Fluter has no heir, Smoyd has no heir, Gwydion has no heir. You could argue that, well, you know, you're always in battle scenes and stuff, so of course there aren't children around. But I just find it a little bit strange that in a land where there's kings crawling all over the place, there's not, you know, more emphasis on these guys having heirs to their thrones. And there's not a lot of women either. You see a lot of male characters. And very, very few female characters. I think mm-hmm. there's this kind of parallel between the barrenness of the land and the barrenness of the people in a certain way. And then you get to the end and there's Henwen with her piglets. And it's sort of mm-hmm. this symbol of this dawning of a new era where Prydain is going to flower again. And as we know from kind of the epilogue, that is exactly what happens, not magically, but through a lot of hard work and, you know, an effort. But I think it's a beautiful kind of just teaser of the sense that, yes, everything's going to be okay.
Yes. During the burning and collapse of Aran's fortress, Gurgi and Glu escape from the hall. The two of them actually found the hall where all of the magical mm-hmm. implements were that Aran stole all those mm-hmm. years ago. And then there's this one little metal box that Gurgi picks up
I think it's glue. It is glue. Yeah. Cause he
and
gives,
then,
gives time.
And then, oh yeah, it was Gurgi who gave it to Taran.
Yeah.
But anyway, so even though all the implements get destroyed in the fire and the collapse, within that box are the written secrets of all the
smithing, farming,
mm-hmm. all the crafting. Yeah. And that's what they have to begin the new life of the nation.
All the things that we learn about in one of the Foundling stories, I believe.
Right. The smith, the weaver, and the harper.
What we learn at the end of the High King is that nobleness, as it's written on Durnwin, nobleness is in your heart, not in your blood.
Dawn, as you described in the walking proverb of Gwydion, you see that coming from Colin Dalbin as well.
Yeah.
But it was I think, Taran's words that struck me more than anybody else, and he says this shortly after Anlaw Clayshaper was killed. It says, "My way is not the warrior's way. Yet if I do not bear my sword now, there will be no place for the usefulness and beauty of any craftsman handiwork. And if I fail, I will have lost all that I have gained."
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sorry, Dawn, I had another question for you. You had mentioned the piglets.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see, a family growing. You did see a big family in Lonio. Now, was there significance to that? And my memory is also failing me. Lonio, he was killed in a battle as well, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So is there significance to that as well?
I don't know. I haven't thought as much about that. I think that Lonio creates his family, creates kind of a prototype of what Taran, he has no experience in a family with children and with two mm-hmm. parents. And mm-hmm. it's a very sweet scene mm-hmm. back in Wanderer where he's with them and kind of how he's very shy and awkward around kids, which again, mm-hmm. Brings to bear the fact that there just aren't a lot around. So I think, and then the fact that mm-hmm. it's Lasar, one of Lonio's children, I think is the one who, kind of hero worships him in this book.
Lasar was from Esau, the comet that Taran saved.
Okay, sorry, I'm getting all the names confused. But anyway, Lonio does. I like to think that they probably gave Caer Dalbyn to Lonio's widow and her family to farm.
Yeah, I think that Lonio died as a way of showing how much loss was endured from war. To give Taran something else to stay and be High King and take care of.
Mm-hmm.
Then Lonio's death for the longest time was my least favorite part of the whole Prydain series, and the reason is it wasn't even mentioned during the battle. It was just kind of an afterthought after the battle. And Lonio was among the fallen. But for me, he's one of my favorite characters because of his optimistic nature. Mm-hmm. But a realization struck me very recently that so when Lloyd wrote The High King, it was before he had written Taran Wanderer, and went back and rewrote Taran Wanderer, which is where Lonio was created, and went back and did revisions on The High King. And my theory is that he had already written that battle scene, and so rather than writing Lonio's death into the scene, he mentions afterwards that he was among mm-hmm. the fallen.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that's the case, I don't have confirmation, but...
Yeah, you're right.
And so now I'll ask again, do we have any other final thoughts about the High King before we move on?
I actually know just a little bit about heraldry. And as we know, the banner of Caer Dalbyn is a green field with a white pig on it. And so in heraldic terms, this blazon is described historically as vert, a pig argent. Vert meaning green field and argent meaning white or silver.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, does that become his emblem, of the new royal house?
Well, since the Sons of Dawn and have left with their emblem, I don't see why not.
And since Ilan, we promised she would fix it when she got a chance.
And hopefully gets the right eye color.
Yeah.
So continuing on to The Foundling, which was written several years later, and it's just a collection of short stories that goes a little bit deeper into the story and the lore. I'd just like to know, maybe Jared, did you have a favorite story?
Well... My favorite story of the Foundling might be more about the history of the compiling of the Foundling rather than one of the specific stories in the book. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's something that right now would be a good time to share.
I'd love to hear it. Yeah. I haven't heard any. I haven't heard this. I'd love to hear it now.
So interestingly, when he finished the High King, he was so torn at being done with the series that he was thinking about these other stories which would take place before the birth of Taran. And he was contemplating writing those into a collection. But then when the High King won the Newbery, he felt like writing the book would be kind of a cash grab, you know, and trying to capitalize off the success of that book. And so he decided not to write those additional stories and just kind of canceled that idea.
Wow.
And that was in 1969. And a couple years later, his editor had moved to another publisher, and he was publishing with another publisher at that point. And in 72, the publisher at Holt that owned the Prydain rights contacted him and said, "Hey, Lloyd, would you be interested in doing any other Prydain stories?" And so at that point, he felt like it had been long enough since the High King that he could revisit and write those stories. So it's kind of an interesting, it almost happened earlier, but then almost never happened. But then luckily in 73, we got the Foundling. But and two of the stories in there, Colin His White Pig and The Truthful Harp, were both originally written as picture books in the 60s at the time he was publishing the other Prydain books. And they weren't added to the Foundling until the 1999 edition. I think those are great additions to the book.
I agree. It's nice to have an all in one book. Yeah. In one compilation, so to speak. My disappointment is that this is not included in any boxed set of the series.
That is odd.
Even though it's published in the same style of cover as the others.
My edition is a single book set of all five books, plus the Foundling. And I do not recognize those stories that you just mentioned. I'm wondering if they were not included in that collection.
That edition was before 99, and so those two would not be in there.
Can you speak briefly to those stories? I'd like to hear a little bit more about them.
Yeah, so Colin His White Pig is the story it's alluded to in the series. In the Book of Three, Gwydion first tells Taran about Henwen being captured by Aran, and it's the story of that happening and then Call going into Anuvin to rescue Henwen. And kind of his journey to rescue her. So, and then The Truthful Harp is the story of Fluter deciding to become a bard and going through bard school and failing miserably, but then being given the gift of the harp from Taliesin.
Yeah.
I'm definitely sad that I missed those. I'm going to have to find them.
Yes.
But then we have, of course, a story of Dalban, and in more detail. And what do we suss out from that story that we didn't gather in the telling that we got through the mainline series?
Oh, we get that like Taran, Dalban himself was a Foundling.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing significantly. We get the origin of the Book of Three, but not really, which is kind of frustrating.
It also has a theme of knowledge being a burden as well as a great freeing tool.
Yes.
In the Book of Three, he suddenly becomes old.
Mm-hmm.
But he also becomes old only after reading all of the sorrowful things. And I often wonder if it's that specific moment that caused that effect on him. Because then he wakes up and finishes reading it, and he gets a resolution, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So the big question, does it actually take him 300 some odd years to read it. Does he actually live? No, I really did wonder when I was a kid. Okay, so he ages essentially overnight while he's reading this book. And when we see him in the beginning of the Book of Three, and it mentions how old he is, and I can't remember it precisely, but it's 300 something.
379.
I remember thinking, so is he literally 379, or is he sort of the equivalent of 379?
Well, no, I always took that literally as 379, but during the sleep that he does, he ages up to the point where he's all white everywhere, but he's not 379. It's just a night's passing.
Yeah.
But he keeps on living a natural life, even though he gets, calendar-wise at least, older still. So he's still alive and kicking when he ends up finding Taran.
Yeah. And then the next story is The Stone, which to me sounded an awful lot like a Twilight Zone episode. And we learned, and I enjoyed it very much because we get to learn a little more about the magic of the fair folk and the way that it interacts with humans. And it's kind of, and I got this from, well, a theme that I'll bring up a little while later, but then the idea that magic isn't, it's almost like the genie in the bottle. You're going to get what you wish for, but you might not like it.
Yeah.
You know, did you guys pick up on more interesting themes within that story?
I think I recognize parallels to, there's a, and I don't remember the exact title, if there is one. I know that there's an old fairy tale in which, you know, a poor farmer captures some sort of magical creature that can grant him wishes. It's a fish or something, a magic fish. Yeah. And he asks for very modest things. And then he goes home and his wife berates him and says, oh, why didn't you ask for this? You could have asked for this. So he keeps going back to the fish and going back to the, and she sends him back like four or five times. And he keeps asking for these more and more outrageous things. And then finally the fish is like, dude, go back home. And it's back to, they're back to whatever, you know, they were at the begin with. And I don't, it's been a long time since I've read The Foundling, and I don't precisely remember the outcome of The Stone, but I remember seeing some very similar just threads there.
Eventually the farmer realizes he liked where he how things were, they weren't so bad, and so he finally gets rid of the stone.
So my question there is he is able to find Dolly again, and maybe I'm not remembering exactly right, but he's able to find Dolly and the stone is able to be taken away. Did Dolly come back because he knew he was going to be needed? Or was it luck that he was able to get rid of the stone?
My guess is he came back because he was very, very reluctant to give the stone in the first place. He said, you know, you mortals don't know what to do with these. It causes trouble. And so I think he knew that sooner or later the farmer was going to want to be rid of the stone. And so he came back to get it. Because he just found him in his field. It wasn't, you know, he stumbled upon him in the forest, but it was in the farmer's field.
And the basic theme is, of course, you get the stone where you're not going to age, but then it's not just that you get to live forever. It's that everything around you totally stagnates. Not only does your beard not grow, but your crops don't grow. And everything is exactly the same, and life loses its flavor. And it's through going through that that the farmer realizes that, no, growing old's not as bad as all that. It's wonderful to be able to go through life and grow through life. And it reminded me of an old Jewish folktale that I heard years and years ago about a man who lived in a very small house with a very large family. And he goes to his rabbi and he says, Rabbi, I'm living in this house and I just do not have the room, but I don't know what to do. I can't afford a larger house. Can you help me? And so the rabbi says, absolutely. You have pigs, right? And the guy says, yeah. And you have chickens, right? And the guy says, yeah. So you have a cow, right? Absolutely. Of course, Rabbi, I do. He says, okay, I want you to bring the pigs in and have the pigs live in the house with you. And the next day he goes back to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, this is awful. There's pigs and there's slop and it's garbage. This is terrible. This is not making it better. So the rabbi says, okay, bring the chickens in with you too. So he goes back the next day. He says, Rabbi, this is even worse. I've got chickens and pigs and they're fighting with each other and it's noisy and it's smelly and it's awful. He says, okay, bring the cow into the house with you. Goes back the next day and he says, this is even worse than before. I don't understand what is going on. How is this supposed to help? And the rabbi says, okay, I want you to take all those animals and I want you to put them back in the barn. And he goes back home and of course now there's all this room. So it's just giving, it's just like Dolly, just like the Dolly and the rabbi, they're both giving perspective on this life and making you realize, well, it's probably not as bad as you think it is. Just give it some perspective. So then the next story I read was The True Enchanter.
Yes.
And Miles, you said you wanted to talk about this.
It's my favorite. That's all I really wanted to say.
Okay.
I like how the point of it seemed to be that it wasn't magic or anything or some extra power that makes a man worthy of being a husband. It's his reality, his honesty and his own brand of magic through storytelling and the power of words and communication.
Mm.
And I thought it was really sweet, the scene where they hold hands and make all the monsters and everything else bad go away.
Mm. Mm, yes. And I felt like that story was very much up to interpretation. I mean, there's a theme through it, but I felt like there was more of the same theme that, Don, I believe you brought up in the last episode, where magic is almost the easy way out. It's kind of like the force is the dark side more powerful? No, it's just quicker, easier, and more seductive.
Right.
The true magic is, you know, within your heart, which I think we're going to see that theme again in a few minutes.
Longley being one of my favorite characters, that story obviously has a nice spot with me as well. I like that it just gives us a glimpse into, you know, a place and a family that we're just kind of teased by in the books proper. To be able to see Angharad and Rigat and kind of figure, it gives me a lot of scope for imagination and what Ilongwa's heritage would have been and kind of some of the things that went into making her who she is. It was very nice to come to a character who, so strongly, you know, reminded me of her. And then also, just gives you a little bit of insight into, you know, where she came from. So it's a very sweet, very simple story, but it probably to me felt the most like reading the original book.
I loved how Angharad dismissed the boasts of the first two enchanters. Like, I can blot out the sun and make the sky dark. Well, yeah, there's this thing called nighttime, you know.
Yeah, and I love kind of what Don was saying, just to get that glimpse into Ilonwy's parents. And I mean, we get a little bit in the series into her parents, but it's more the tragedy of of her parents, and specifically her mother Angharad. But here, you know, to get her personality a little more, and it feels like Don was saying, like Ilonwy, it's easy to see where Ilonwy's strong personality comes from, and it just was such a pleasure to read this story more about her parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that can lead us then into the next story, which is The Sword, which is a very interesting backstory behind Durnwin and how it came to be what it is. And I couldn't place my finger on it exactly, but this felt very reminiscent of some kind of older story to me. Did you guys pick up on anything? This comes from some folklore or anything interesting in that regard? Or just what did you think of the story?
Well, the sword might be my favorite out of the stories in the Foundling, but it's probably because it ends in a tomb, which reminds me a whole lot of Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was specifically the Last Crusade where they find Sir Richard.
So basically the concept here is, you, and I can't remember the name of the character, but
Ritta.
Right. Who has got these feelings that there's a betrayal, that he's going to be hunted down from enemies without.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually starts from a simple mistake. That he was riding on his way to a hunt and he damages the gate of a shepherd. And the shepherd comes to him and says, basically, you damaged my gate. This is important to my flock. Will you please repair it? And he says, absolutely, I will. But then he forgets. And through a series of increasing hubris. This shepherd loses his flock and much more, and it starts this vicious cycle that culminates in what reminded me of a Mad King Ares or other. I know there was a historical figure that was very similar to this of some kind, but I'm not well versed in history enough to know what it is, where he's sending out his armies to hunt down and destroy all of my enemies, and he won't go out on his own. Mm-hmm. And is that because, refresh my memory, is that because he's not able to draw the sword anymore?
He kills the shepherd and it stains the sword, and that's at that point when it starts to turn black?
That's correct.
Yes. And the more death that he orders to take place, the blacker the sword becomes.
Because its use has been perverted somehow. I can't remember if it actually describes why he has the sword or where it came from to begin with.
It's inherited from, Rita has it inherited from his grandfather.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's not told.
Okay. Mm. It's interesting to me that it's clearly, by the time we get to, you know, the Prydain five books, it's obviously an extremely powerful sword. And mm-hmm. you wonder, at what point was it imbued with this sort of power? And is this the origin story? Is it a blessing or a curse that it's this? It's interesting to me that an object that's clearly intended to be good in the original books is mm-hmm. now in this story. The sword itself is not evil, but it's corruption. The mm-hmm. whole reason it's black is because of corruption on the part of its wielder. I just mm-hmm. find it kind of a fascinating sort of mm-hmm. contrast or irony. I'm not sure. It's mm-hmm. interesting.
On the other hand, I think that's the only thing that changes about Durnwen is its color. Its mm-hmm. nature doesn't mm-hmm. change.
Right.
Yeah, and the words that are scratched out of the scabbard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I believe that's the case then. He's able to draw it and use it as a sword up until the point where he starts to lose his way.
Right.
And isn't it that he tries to draw it at one point and he's unable to?
Yeah, he can't draw it, but that's what ultimately kills him at the end, is he just pulls it with all his might and it comes right. free, but he had unsheathed only a hand's breadth of the blade, and that's mm-hmm. what kills him and everyone in the room. Lightning comes from the sword.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Yeah, only enough to be destroyed by it.
Right.
So great sword of power draw Durnwen only of noble birth. Or noble worth, and he loses that nobility and is then not able to draw the sword.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's kind of losing his mind. He's visited by the ghost of the shepherd every night. He's unable to right his wrong and admit his failings and correct for it. So rather he digs these tunnels. And have any of you guys ever heard of the Winchester Mystery House?
Yes.
Nope.
So long story short is that the Winchester, as it, in terms of the gun manufacturer, the Winchester widow was very, very wealthy, but was felt like she was being haunted by all the victims of her family's destructive device that made all this money. So she feels like she's being haunted by all the victims of the guns that she has created. So she builds this house that doesn't make any sense. There's doors that lead nowhere, that lead outside, staircases that go nowhere. And it's this hidden, all these hidden passages and all these rooms so that she can be hiding from these ghosts that are coming for her. And this creation of Spiral Castle and the tunnels. And, you know, it never made much sense to me, the Spiral Castle in the beginning, but reading this, it makes perfect sense. And I love that. And I've always wanted to visit the Winchester Mystery House for that same reason. I think it would be a lot like this.
Better bring some beans so you can spit them.
Yeah. Good point. And that is how you learn that the sword finds its way into this tomb, and how all of these people were in this tomb and killed with that sword there in the depths of this castle.
And it's kind of ironic, that comment about the beans just made me make a connection. So, I mean, he dies in that tomb underneath the castle
mm-hmm.
because the ghost of the shepherd is there mm-hmm. and haunting him. And the next time we see that tunnel in the Book of Three, the wind coming through sounds like ghosts, and they're afraid that there are ghosts there.
That's an interesting point. Very interesting.
Kind of ironic. I don't know that it was intended at the time it was written, or maybe it was, but.
And one other thing I picked up on, and this is very loose, admittedly, but it just hit me as well. Dawn, earlier you mentioned how Alanwi was a Lightbringer. The creation of this sword, or perhaps I should say the tainting of this sword with blood, reminds me of the story of Azor Ahai from A Song of Ice and Fire, creating the sword Lightbringer. And it's not identical by any stretch of the imagination, but I felt there were similarities there. It's interesting that you mentioned Lightbringer.
And of course, the next story in the series is The Rascal Crow.
Please tell us about The Rascal Crow.
So that's the story of Cadwir, who's the sire crow of Ka, or Cadwir, I guess. So we have Medwin once again, and there's a huntsman that's out gathering the animals for Aran, and he captured the Gwythaints that Medwin mentions. And so he tells all the animals, you know, watch out, kind of lock yourselves up, don't be out there. But Cadwir, the crow, is very cocky, I guess, just very, nothing can hurt me. And he tells all these other animals, he tells the gnats and the turtle, and he kind of makes fun of them for being so afraid, and the spiders. But then he's out there and he runs into this hunter, and the hunter's chasing him, and he ends up getting wounded, and so he can't really escape. And it's the other animals that he made fun of that end up helping him become saved from the hunter.
Yeah, and he's always got some kind of snarky comment to throw out there also. I found him to be a very entertaining rascal.
Yeah.
And of course, Medwin is, it felt like Medwin was like the high school teacher who is amused by the disobedience of the students. That's not the way you should be behaving, but I am very intrigued and entertained by you.
I think it's very, I love the character of Medwin and how he remembers all these animals and their ancestry lines. Like this guy probably has no idea what's going on in the human world, but he remembers all these animals, and it's just a reminder of the kind of the whimsy of that, which I loved.
Which you in Lord of the Rings, you see very, very little of Radagast. He's always one of my favorite characters from the books because you know very little about him, very mysterious. But then in the movies, you see this absolutely ridiculous, complete animal-focused character. It's almost as if I would say the movie version of Radagast is a caricature of Medwin, almost more than he is Radagast from the books.
Yeah, I did not care for how he was portrayed. Medwin, although there is, you know, a little bit of humor there in how he interacts with the animals, is a very dignified character, and he treats the animals with dignity. You kind of, to me, I get the impression that this man sort of thinks like an animal, and that's why he understands them, and there's a lot of beauty in that, and like I said, dignity. It's not a ridiculous character at all, and I would have liked to see them treat Radagast the same way.
Agreed. And so I do believe that does leave us into the final story, The Smith, the Weaver, and the Harper. Can somebody tell us a little bit about the story behind that particular tale?
We talked about it a little bit when we were doing, is it Tower and Wonder? An historical account of when Aran was first traveling through the land and stealing secrets of the arts and crafts of Prydain. And he comes upon, I don't remember the order of things, but he comes upon one of the weavers, with the master weaver, and tricks him out of his shuttle by offering, you know, a new and different one that does all the work itself. And it's shiny, and so,
and it spins pure gold or silver.
Yeah, it's purple silver. Yeah, and so, you know, moved by the promise of all this wealth and leisure, the weaver gives up the shuttle, and Aran disappears with this, what is essentially a treasure, because it's imbued with all the knowledge and skill of this artisan. and they're left with this useless, what turns out to be a useless, mm-hmm. you know, trinket. And the same thing happens mm-hmm. with the smith, who loses his hammer. And then the last one is the bard. Is it, and remind me, is it Taliesin or is it a different one? Is it
it's Menwi.
Menwi. Yes, the original bard, mm-hmm. which I thought so. And out of all of them, he is the one that sees through the guise. And I can't remember exactly how it goes down. I just remember that he refuses the gift. It was probably a harp, I think, that that Oron mm-hmm. was offering.
And he's almost taunting Oron. Right. He openly admits, mm-hmm. I am scared of you. You are, how did he say it? Something along the lines of, you know, you could destroy me, but no, I'm not giving you my harp. Please, go ahead, Jared.
He says, I see you for what you are, Lord of Death, and I fear you as all men do. For all that, you are a weak and pitiful king. You can destroy, but never build. You are less than the humblest creature, the frailest blade of grass. For these live, and every moment of their lives is a triumph over you. Your kingdom is dust, only the silent ending of things, never the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so powerful. And it's interesting to me that, you know, out of these three, well, first of all, the things that he chooses, the types of skills that Lloyd chooses in this, and that the bard is the one who sees through the guise. And I think it comes into his philosophy of storytelling being often a way into deeper truth than you could get at mm-hmm. through just fact. The fact that it is the storyteller, it is the bard who hits on the truth of the matter.
And the fact that story creates life, mm-hmm. which the Lord of Death, even the last sentence of that is, and the Lord of Death fled in terror of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Perfect.
This has been my favorite story out of the entire collection ever since I read it when I was a kid. And I feel like Menwi, he just evokes so much joy and happiness that Aran fears.
Mm.
And that is just so great to me. I love it.
That he defeats him not through, you know, weaponry, but mm-hmm. just simple understanding of truth and joy. I think that it kind of sums up everything I personally, not ever having known him, but suspect that Alexander himself would have, you know, attempted to make his life motto or philosophy, that, you know, those are the things that
mm-hmm.
are going to defeat evil.
And something I had spoken about with Don in the past, but not really in public, is I find a lot of similarities between Menwi and Geraint from The True Enchanter. Mm-hmm. And the way both of them, they use their abilities, and for Geraint, it is magic in a way, or what some might call faux magic. And for Menwi, it's the magic of music in storytelling. And I feel like both of these characters just emit such joy, and they just, they're living in the moment, and it almost feels like they're invincible in a way because of that.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Beautiful story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed discussing every aspect of these books with everybody on this podcast. I'm very glad for you all to have joined. I'm going to open this up now. If anybody has any final thoughts before we close out, please speak up.
Well, I'd like to also mention, if the listeners have gotten this far, then maybe I could ask a favor of them. The Foundling, out of all the six books, The Foundling is the only one that has not been produced as an audiobook. And so I remember, after getting through the audiobooks for the first time and then going through the paper book of The Foundling, I then went to the Listening Library website and wrote a letter to them asking them to have James Langton, who is the narrator for the series, come back and narrate all the stories in The Foundling. So if anybody has enjoyed these audiobooks or books as much as I have, I encourage them to likewise write a letter to Listening Library.
Might as well complete the complete the series.
I also listened to these on audio and really, really liked James Langton and his voice talents.
Well, if I can plug something real quick.
Please do.
Since you brought up audio. I was contacted just a few months back by a young man who runs his own audio drama. I'm going to call it a company, although he works so far exclusively in a fan capacity. So it's a nonprofit, and he's just doing these things because he loves them. He is currently developing a unauthorized and unlicensed audio drama of the Prydain Chronicles. He had asked me to adapt the books into a an audio script to be used in this endeavor. And I recently posted a link to it on my Facebook page because he has now come out officially and announced it on his page, which is called Vocalab Productions, and you can find that on Facebook. So I'm sure he would love a little extra publicity. He's looking for people to cast as the voice talent. And I'm sure he would love for true fans of the series to get involved in any way possible. So there you go.
Awesome.
In all fan material, similar to my comic, it could get shut down anytime should the copyright holder decide to.
I will be sure to audition for the part of Glue.
Can be the most hated character. it's exciting. Right now, obviously, we're just working on the first book, and hopefully if that's successful, he'll go on to do some more. And I always, in all these things, I'm always just hopeful that if it's discovered by Henry Holt or whoever else would own any rights to audio dramas, that they would simply consider it free publicity. So
does anybody know, by the way, here present, who does control the intellectual property? I know that in his will, he willed all of the proceeds from his works to the Free Library of Philadelphia, but I don't know who controls the rights to his works.
It's extremely complicated. Yeah. I can talk to you more about it later if you would like. Well, for anyone that enjoys these books and enjoyed listening to these podcasts, a few years ago I did make a documentary about the life and writings of Lloyd Alexander, and it is available to the public on YouTube. So you can just do a Google search or a YouTube search for Lloyd Alexander documentary, and it will come up. It was certainly a pleasure to make and to learn more about his life, and it's something that I just hope other people can be drawn to his books by viewing that.
Yes, and I've seen that documentary. It is quite excellent.
I agree.
I have the T-shirt too.
It's also been recommended that you should check out the Prydain Companion, a reference guide to Lloyd Alexander's Prydain Chronicles. Handy reference and a very informative book, highly recommended by this group.
Well, once again, thank you all very much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. We hope to do some more episodes with you guys on different books, different series in the future. And thank you to all our listening audience for joining us. Have a nice evening.